On the first slide, you can see the first silly title I gave some time ago when I had not decided what to talk about. And then you see a more precise title. So I'm going to present a new representation for group field theory, and which shows a duality between simplicial path integrals and spin flow models. So you can go to slide 2. So the main aim of this talk is to show that there exists such a duality, that you can understand it as the covariant counterpart of a duality between a triad or metric representation for quantum gravity states and the spin network representation. I'm going to discuss this duality at the level of group field theory. And this shows up as a new non-commutative representation of the same group field theories. So that's the first point. Then I want to convince you that it's useful to use this duality in order to make some progress in understanding the geometry of spin network states and of spin foam amplitude, to encode this geometry in the group field theory action. Then after doing this, it's useful because it helps in studying the symmetries of spin foam models, in particular diffuse, at the group field theory level. And then it can be a good starting point for constructing group field theories for four-dimensional quantum gravity. Then, if I have time, I will point out some open issues for further work. But the main aim of the talk is to stimulate some discussion. So if you have questions at any point, I'm very happy to try to answer. So you go to slide 3. So let me first start with an analogy. The way I understand this duality between simplicial path integrals for gravity and spin foam models is best understood, I think, in terms of what happens for a single point particle. For example, consider a point particle in a circle with a simple position-dependent potential. You discretize the time interval, so the space-time, if you want, on which the particle lives. And you can define a transition amplitude for this, the propagator, if you want, which encodes fully the dynamics of the model. And you can write it down as an ordinary, classical-looking path integral in which the only effect of the fact that the particle lives on a circle is in the boundary conditions for the integration over configuration variables. Or you can rewrite everything in terms of the quantum numbers labeling the states of the same particle, which in momentum space are, of course, integers, because the configuration space circle is compact.
So a question. So is this inequality exact, or?
Yeah. I'm just rewriting.
Is it guessed, or is it a guess, or is it derived?
No, it is derived. I found it in a textbook, so it's actually standard material. And I guess with some effort, I could derive it myself. Yeah. So the first one is just the classical path integral, of course, discretized.
Is there any significance to the hat on edge?
The fact that I think I've chosen a specific ordering in case you need to specify the ordering.
But this is just a classical Hamiltonian.
Yeah. Okay. Again, what I mean with the hat there is that is the classical counterpart, and you can hear it enters only in terms of a number, in terms of the C number corresponding to the original operator. But it can be constructed from the quantum states.
Okay. And then in the first line, why is the integral for dq going from minus infinity to infinity?
It could be a typo. It could be actually from zero to infinity. Yeah, I think you're right. So these are just the quantum numbers for the momenta. So I guess that if I'm not doing any symmetrization on the orientation, it should be from zero to infinity.
No, but isn't it in a circle?
And dqj should be just 0 to 2 pi, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so... Yeah, so these two expressions are what later will become the classical path integral discretized and the spin foam rewriting of the same. So here again, it's a little bit still confusing, as I note at the end of the slide, because also the expression of the same propagator in terms of quantum numbers looks just like the classical path integrals, only with discrete integers instead of the classical continuum variables for the momenta. So on the second slide, on the fourth slide, you can see the same expression in terms of quantum numbers, but for a particle on the sphere, so if on the tree sphere, so basically on SU2. So the classical path integral is the same form, with appropriate, and you have to encode the appropriate boundary conditions on the configuration integral. On the other hand, the analog of the spin foam representation is given by the eigenfunction expansion for the same propagator. So it's basically given by the expansion in spherical harmonics. And okay, it's a simple form, but it doesn't look at all like a continuum path integral. Okay, the point is that these two representations are again equivalent, and they have complementary advantages and difficulties. So which one you prefer to use depends on the answer, on the question you want to answer. So slide number five. So what I'm suggesting is there exists a similar duality between spin foam models and gravity path integrals. It's in a simplicial context because the spin foam models that we consider at the moment are in fact in a simplicial context. So there are two equivalent ways of expressing the dynamics of quantum geometry. One can already forecast the possible advantages of the two pictures. In a discrete path integral formulation, you expect to have a much clearer grasp on the geometric structure. You expect that it's simpler to analyze the semi-classical approximation of your dynamics in terms of discrete path integral. After all, path integrals have been introduced exactly for this purpose. I mean, among the others, actually. And it's easier in a path integral formulation to make contact with the classical action and with the classical dynamics, and to study the symmetries of your theory. On the other hand, in the spin foam formulation, you have a much clearer algebraic structure. You know, you make contact with the structure of quantum states and with the canonical theory in a much more straightforward way. So the other two points I want to make very briefly is that we already know that such a duality is true, at least at the level of partition function for 3D gravity. And we also know it is true in lattice gauge theory, both for the Heat kernel action or for the Wilson action on the lattice. And I refer you to the paper by Robert and Hendrik a few years ago. Okay, so move to slide number six.
Sorry, just one clarification. Throughout you refer to the discrete path integrals or simplicial path integrals. By that you just mean the Regge approach or something else?
But I'm going to show you exactly what is the simplicial path integral corresponding to the Pondrano-Regge model in 3D, for example. But in general, I simply mean a discrete path integral for some choice of action on a simplicial complex. Then which action depends on the, I mean, is a bit like specifying the spin foam model on the other side. So here okay. I'm just suggesting that there exists a duality between some spin foam model and some simplicial path integral. Which one will depend on the model?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so slide number six. Let me recapitulate briefly what we know about the Ponzano-Regge model from this perspective. So we consider the continuum theory given by the first order formulation of gravity in terms of Lie algebra valued triad one form and an SU2 connection, one form, with corresponding curvature. Then we introduce a simplicial complex and its topological dual, and I represented here the basic building block of the simplicial complex and its topological dual, so a tetrahedron and the corresponding dual vertex with dual lines. And what we want to do is to discretize this theory. So we assign the algebra elements to the edges of the triangulation that you can think of as coming from the integration of the continuum triad field over the same edges. Here, of course, they assume an embedding in order to interpret the variables this way. In the end, we have the algebra variable for edges of the triangulation. And then instead we discretize the continuum connection in terms of the parallel transport along dual edges of the complex, so that we assign group elements to the edges, to the links of the dual complex, as it is done in lattice gauge theory. And the discretization of the curvature is given by the product of group elements of parallel transports along the boundary of a dual phase. So we have an holonomy, so a discrete curvature associated with each dual phase. And in 3D, this means a dual curvature associated to each edge of the triangulation. That's why the notation GF equal to GA, GE. Okay, so slide 7. We define our discrete counterpart for the continuum action. And it corresponds at least in the sense of naive continuum limit and in terms of equation, discrete equations and symmetries to the continuum 3D graph.
Hello.
Hello. We seem to have lost the speaker.
Yep.
AI with us? Or speaker, we can't hear anything. Do other people hear?
Yeah. Hello?
Maybe just...
Marseille is still here. I think it's Daniele that lost the connection.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I don't hear him either.
Yeah, I lost my connection at Western, too. I had to call back in.
Does anybody, Carlo, for example, do you have Daniele's cell phone or something? One can call him?
I don't have Daniele's number, but I have the number of some other people at the PI that I will go and try to find.
Okay.
One minute.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello.
Ah, sorry, we're back. I swear we didn't do anything.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. So, we are at slide 7. So, we define our discrete action for the same, for the our discrete variables. Discrete triad meaning the algebra elements assigned to edges of the triangulation, and group elements assigned to dual links, which enter the action through their holonomy, so through the discrete curvature. We define the path integral for the discrete theory, and then we can check that if we do the integral over the algebra variables, we obtain an expression purely in terms of group elements, which has the form of a product of delta functions that impose flatness of this holonomy. So we can, of course, derive the corresponding spin-form model from this simplicial path integral, which shows what I mean when I say that you can understand the spin-form model as arising from just a rewriting in terms of different variables of the same quantity, of the same dynamics. So on slide 8, what you do is to decompose the delta in representations of the group. So in terms of characters for the same group elements, then you can decompose the characters in representation functions. And then you simply do the integrals over the SU2 group elements so that you are left with the function of the representations only. And the final result after the contraction of the 3G symbols arising from the group integrations is the well-known Ponzano-Regge model. Okay, so this is just a briefer introductory review. So let me skip the next two slides and go to slide 11. So this is what we know already in 3D, so this sort of duality between... is there a question? No. Okay. So we are at slide 11. So what we want to do is to go beyond this equality of partition functions. In particular, we don't know whether such a duality is still there at the level of quantum states or observables, and it's not obvious whether the same equivalence of simplicial path integral and spin form representation is there also for transition amplitudes. And in higher dimension, we know even less, so we don't have an analogous complete path integral representation for the 4D models, for example, the new EPR or EPRL spinform models. The Barre-Crane model with some simple choice of weight has been derived from a path integral, but again at the level of partition function, so it's not obvious whether we can go beyond, and we don't know exactly what is the counterpart of the simple measure that has been chosen in the spin form representation at the simplicial level, at the level of simplicial path integrals. In general, we don't have an explicit definition of the mapping between these two representations, so we cannot really speak of a duality. Now I move on to realize this duality at the level of group field theory. So why we do that, why I do that, why I think is interesting is because group field theories can be already interpreted as a sort of second quantized theory of simplicial geometry on the one end and of canonical loop quantum gravity on the other hand, in the sense that the field represents a second quantized D-1 simplex or equivalently a spin network vertex. At the moment, this is simply a pictorial representation of the field, but we'll show that there is more to it than this. So we also know that the Feynman diagrams for the group field theories are two complexes, which are basically spin form complexes, which are topologically dual to simplicial complexes, and that the amplitudes for the same group field theories have an interpretation of implementing covariantly the dynamics of both simplices or equivalently spin networks. So we can expect them to be related to path integrals for simplicial gravity. And we know already, that, thanks to Mike and Carlo, that they can always be represented as spin form models. Of course, there are more reasons to focus on the group field theory formulation, but I'm not going to discuss them here. So slide number 12.
I have a comment, I'm sorry. The 11th slide, number 11. I think people working in group field theory or spin form models understand what you mean by second quantization here. But I just want to clarify that, in fact, the quantum theory you're obtaining is modulo to the issue about topology change is the same as loop quantum gravity. It is not like a third quantization of general relativity. It really is just quantization of general relativity.
Sure. You said modulo the issue of topology change.
Yes.
And I agree.
Okay.
Okay. Slide number 12. So now for a few slides, I recapitulate what we know already about the Bulatov model for 3D Riemannian quantum gravity. So I show again a duality between a group representation and a spin form representation for the Feynman amplitudes of the theory and for the action. After this, we'll go beyond. these two representations. So the basic object of our theory is a real field valued in the real numbers, and which depends on three group elements in SU2. We also impose a symmetry, which is a symmetry under the diagonal action of the group on the three arguments. You can think of the field as corresponding to be the field corresponding to the loop quantum gravity cylindrical function in the connection representation, at least for a single spin network vertex. So you can impose the invariance I mentioned under the diagonal action of the group through a projection operator. Everything here is well defined also thanks to the fact that the group is compact. And the action has the form I write there. So the way you choose the combinatorics of arguments in the interaction is thinking of the field again as describing a triangle. It's three arguments as being associated to the edges of this triangle. And then you combine the arguments of the four fields in the interaction, just as you combine, just as you glue four triangles in a tetrahedron along common edges. So each two fields share one argument, have one argument in common, just as two triangles in a tetrahedron have one edge in common. And then the kinetic term just represents the gluing of two tetrahedra along identified triangles, common triangles. So at the moment, the only understanding we have of the quantum theory is through the perturbative expansion of the partition function. So we expand in Feynman diagrams. By construction, these Feynman diagrams will be dual to three-dimensional simplicial complexes. And the Feynman amplitudes that they can be constructed straightforwardly after identifying the kinetic term and the vertex term from the above action in the group picture, are given by the same partition function of 3D gravity in a pure group representation that I wrote a few slides earlier. Okay, so you just have a product of delta functions for products of group elements, each associated to a dual link, so to a link of the Feynman diagram. And the argument of the delta function is the product of dual links along the boundary of the dual two cell. And you integrate, of course, over all the group elements to get the partition function. Okay, keep in mind, of course, that this is just the Feynman amplitude of a richer theory in the sense that this enters within a sum over triangulations, a sum over Feynman diagrams with appropriate weights, depending only on the combinatorics of these Feynman diagrams. And I write the full expression in the previous slide. So slide number 13. So of course we can repeat the same calculation of the Feynman amplitudes in representation space. So what we do is to expand the field over the field over SU2 cube in representations of the group. You see the expression. And somehow this is the analogous of the spin network representation for the loop quantum gravity wave function, cylindrical function, corresponding to the field. And once you plug in this expansion of this expression for the field in the action, in the group field theory action, the end result for the Feynman amplitude in representation space is, again, the Ponzano-Regge model. So what we see, again, is the equality between a pure group expression, so an expression for the Feynman amplitudes, so for the amplitude that you associate to a single simplicial complex in terms of group elements only, and the corresponding spinform model. Still, one cannot talk about the simplicial path integral at this stage, in the sense that there are no triad or metric variables in the formalism. There are only either group elements or the quantum numbers labeling the states, the spin networks, for the theory, for the quantum geometry. This makes it difficult to read out the simplicial geometry from these quantum amplitudes, both in the left-hand side of the equation and on the right-hand side. It's not easy to study the semi-classical approximation of these amplitudes, as people who have studied the asymptotic limit of the CG symbol know. And it's not easy to identify the symmetries that we know are present in the BF theory that is behind this expression at the level of the Grufeld theory. Moreover, if you try to move to four dimensions, it's difficult to impose, it's not easy to find the correct way of imposing the simplicity Lebesgue constraint that give you gravity out of BF theory, for the simple reason that you don't have the bivector variables, the classical bivector variables that appear in the Lebesgue formulation and on which the simplicity constraints are imposed. So we move to slide 14. So the work I'm going to discuss is based on, is for a good part in progress, and is based on several sub-projects in collaboration with Aristide Baratin and with Florian Girelli, with Bianca Dietrich, and with Johannes Tambornino. So in particular, I'm going to present first the general setup for a non-commutative metric triad or tetrad representation for the group field theories. Then I'm going to show you how you can see one specific symmetry of BF theory at the group field theory level, directly at the group field theory level, thanks to this representation. I'm going to discuss briefly how you can interpret this representation as the flux representation for kinematical loop quantum gravity states. And then I'm going to discuss, if I have time, how you can use all this to construct four-dimensional models for gravity, so how you impose the simplicity constraints. Okay. Of course, all this is based on a lot of previous work and ideas by several people, and I apologize if already in this slide I may have missed some of them, and if later on I don't mention the names of all the people involved. So slide 14. So a little bit of preliminaries. So the crucial tool that we are going to use is a non-commutative Fourier transform that had been introduced by Majid in the mathematical literature, but then in the quantum gravity literature by Laurent Friedel and Etera Living. So, and then whose mathematical properties have been studied in more detail by Laurent himself and by Majid. So consider the case of the Fourier algebra. It's a non-commutative algebra with the usual Pauli, with the usual basis that can be represented in terms of Pauli matrices. On such a non-commutative space, you can define non-commutative plane waves that I will call E of G and X, depending on X, so I treat them as function of the Lie algebra elements, depending on the group element G. And they form a basis for functions on the Lie algebra. So you can think of functions on the Lie algebra as functions on R3, which is isomorphic to the Lie algebra as a vector space. But you have to endow this vector space with a star product, so the space of functions with a star product, so to reflect appropriately the non-commutativity of the algebra. So the way you define these plane waves, these non-commutative plane waves, is by taking the exponential of the trace in the fundamental representation of the given Lie algebra element and the given group element, of course, again, in the fundamental representation, the two elements on which the plane wave depends. Using this plane wave, you can define a Fourier transform from functions on the group to the space of functions on R3 with the star product. And I write the expression for this Fourier transform below. So the star product, in turn, is defined on plane waves in order to respect, so to mimic, the group multiplication. This means that the star product for functions on the Lie algebra, so for functions on R3, will be dual to the convolution product for functions on the group by construction. And you see there the definition of the star product between plane waves. And of course, you extend this by linearity on generic functions on R3. So, modulo some issues that I'm not going to discuss, but okay, I'm of course happy to talk about if you want. You can invert this Fourier transform, getting functions on the group from functions on a tree using the same star product. And I write the inverse formula below. You can extend this definition as shown in the paper by Laurent and Majid to general compact groups, in particular to spin 4. So slide number 16, still in the preliminary part. If you want to have a more intuitive understanding of these functions on a tree endowed with a star product, you can think of them as functions on a tree such that if you take their Fourier transform with respect to the usual Fourier transform on a tree, they are shown to be bounded momentum. Yeah, so they only have support in momentum space with respect to the usual Fourier transform on the tree ball. Was there a question? Okay, I assume I can go on. Okay, you can define delta functions. So you can define the Fourier transform of the delta function you can define delta functions on the group in terms of the displaying waves, and delta functions on the on R3, again using plane waves, and I write the expression. Two important properties of these delta functions are worth noticing. So one is that when you use these delta functions within an integration over the Lie algebra, so an integration over R3, and you take care in multiplying, as you should, the delta function with an ordinary function with a function on R3 using the star product, any constraint that forms the argument of the delta function is imposed strongly. So it is exactly a delta function, although from the point of view of an ordinary function on R3, so if you basically neglect the fact that you have to multiply with a star product, they look like a regularized or smoothed delta function. In particular, the evaluation at zero of this delta function as a function on R3 is actually finite. So these are two important properties for what will follow. And basically the only formula that is needed for later calculation, almost, is the convolution between functions on the group in the Lie algebra representation. And I write here the corresponding kernel called GXY. So it's a function of two arguments on the Lie algebra. Okay, so now the idea is to use this non-commutative Fourier transform to turn group field theories into non-commutative field theories on several copies of the Lie algebra. And we will see that these Lie algebra elements that enter the group field theory in the dual space are the B variables of BF theory. Okay, in order to see the motivation for expecting this, you can note, for example, that holonomy and B variables in BF are canonically conjugate. So you expect them to be related by some sort of Fourier transform. And then in loop quantum gravity, this mere triad, the triad variables do not commute. So you expect some sort of non-commutative structure to be needed if you want to have a representation in terms of the triad. So I mentioned also, because we use it, the fact that you can extend this non-commutative Fourier transform to functions on several copies of the group, basically extending from a single plane wave to a tensor product of plane waves evaluated at different points. Okay, slide number 17. So now what we do is to take the Vulatov model for 3D gravity that I introduced earlier. Same action, same invariance under the group, under the diagonal group action. I write it as an action on the left because it's completely equivalent at this stage. So now what we can see is that, what we do is to evaluate to evaluate the Fourier transform, the non-commutative Fourier transform for this function on three copies of the group. And the invariance under the diagonal action, the left diagonal action, can be seen as the, in Fourier space, as the action of a projector C acting on the field of trivial algebra elements. So the geometric interpretation of this is that you think of the field as a triangle characterized by three triad elements, so by three the algebra elements associated to the three edges of it, of the triangle. Now, what is important to notice at this point, at least it was important to me for understanding what was going on, is that you can see that the Fourier transform of the diagonal projection is nothing else than the closure constraint for these triad variables. So if you already understood in this way the diagonal action of the group in usual group field theories, well, now in Fourier space you have a, how to say, you can use this as a confirmation that you're doing the right thing when using this Fourier transform. If it was not clear to you while one was imposing the diagonal action of the group, the invariance and the diagonal action of the group in group field theories, now this gives a geometric understanding of this, I think, in a rather clear way. So notice that because we define our action...
Can you perhaps explain this important point again? I didn't understand what you're saying. I understand the diagonal action, but then you're saying something else, which why it is now clearer, and I don't understand why it is clearer. Can you say it again?
So if you look at the third line in the formula there, you see that what we're doing the Fourier transform of is the projected field under the diagonal action on the left of the group. So you see the third line. So what we are computing here is the Fourier transform using the tensor product of plane waves, one for each argument, of a function which is the integral over H of a field a priori not being invariant under anything. Right?
Right, right.
So we are plugging in the definition of the field in terms of the non-invariant field, if you want. Okay?
Right.
On the left-hand side, we have a... on the first line, what we see is the result of taking the Fourier transform. So it's written as the action of a projector C on the field. Then slightly improperly, because I'm abusing a little bit of notation, what this is just a delta function imposing that the sum of the three variables is zero.
Very good.
Okay. So, what follows is just the exact way of writing this delta function in terms of plane waves and so on.
Right.
But the meaning is that we are imposing that instead of having a generic field, we have a field with its three arguments constrained to sum to zero. If you think of these three arguments, as you should, as the triad variables, the Lie algebra variables associated to the edges of the triangle, what you're imposing is that the triangle should close.
Right.
So, what I'm... Okay, so I hope this is a bit more clear now.
Thank you.
Okay. So, what I wanted to notice is also, to note, is that we are working with the projected field at the level of group field theory action. And the fact that we write it as in terms of the projection of a non-invariant field is, how to say, just a matter of convenience. But that means that we are working with a field that depends on, we are working with triangles that close already. Now, this closure is the discrete analog of the metricity of the connection equation in a first-order theory. So the group field theory action is for a metric second-order theory. Okay, slide number 18. So we rewrite the action in the B basis using this Fourier transform. Now I spare you the detail of the rewriting and the diagrammatics that comes with it. The crucial point is that just like in the group picture, the only thing that you have in the action, in the kinetic term as well as in the vertex term, is a bunch of delta functions identifying group elements group elements, which are the arguments of the field. Now you have the Fourier transform of that, which are exactly the kernels depending on two arguments of the field. He actually, sorry, there is a typo, should be bi, b tilde I in the line just after the formula for the kinetic term. You have this kernel replacing the delta function that appear in the group picture. Okay? So here I'm just doing Fourier transform and isolating what is the contribution to the kinetic term, and you can do the same for the vertex term. In particular, for the vertex term, for the interaction, again, you have a function, a kernel, g b tau b tau prime, so basically a function that identifies the two Lie algebra variables associated to the same edge in two different triangles. And you have a bunch of these two-point functions, these kernels, with the combinatorial pattern of the tree simplex, so the tetrahedron. Again, just as in the group picture, now you identify the algebra elements instead of group elements. And the point is that what you see is that you identify them modulo the parallel transport defined by the H integrations in the formula above. So the geometric meaning of this is transparent. So I just tell you the meaning without dwelling too much into the formula. What it means is that you identify the two Lie algebra elements, the two triads associated to the same edge in two different triangles after parallel transport to the center of the tetrahedron. And you affect this parallel transport by means of the connection represented by the group elements H. This means that you automatically, you are working in a framework in which you have reference frames associated to the triangles and to the simplices, to the tetrahedra. So there is a non-trivial parallel transport from variables expressed in one frame to variables expressed in the other frame. Okay, so this is, again, this is only to stress that all this is naturally encoded in the Goofy Q reaction with no extra input. I'm just reading out the geometric meaning of the formula I get when I do the Fourier transform. So we compute the Feynman amplitudes. And let me stress again, these are exactly the same Feynman amplitudes of the Bulatov model. We just write them in the new representation. And of course, we have to pay special care in the non-commutative structure, so in playing correctly according to rules with the star product. So we do this, slide number 19, I give you the result. I'm slightly, again, abusing of notation, I hope people don't mind. So the result is the formula you see. So what you get is exactly the three-dimensional BF path integral with an additional delta function, and the star product, of course, multiplying the two functions on the Lie algebra, the delta function and the exponential of BH. So what you see is the amplitude for each dual phase, so for each edge of the triangulation, being the exponential of trace in the fundamental representation of the Lie algebra element associated to that edge, so to that dual phase, and the corresponding holonomy, so which is exactly the BF action. And then you have this additional constraint encoded in the delta function. Now, recall the important property that I mentioned earlier, which is that even though we are working in a sense in a regularized space, because the Lie algebra is non-commutative, and even though the delta function, if you think of it as an ordinary function over tree, is a smoothed one, so it's a regularized one, when used like we do here within an integration and multiplying it with other functions to a star product, it imposes the constraint strongly. So it's not this, it's not a relaxed constraint that we are imposing. Anyway, so I don't spend too much time on the meaning of this constraint, but what it means, so you can think of it as the non-commutative analog of the constraint that imposes that that the holonomy lies in the plane orthogonal to the edge to which you associate the triad. So this is a property that characterizes the Levi-Civita connection. So you see that the model contains already more than ordinary first-order BF theory. So you can repeat the same construction in 4D for BF theory, and you get basically the same result. Of course, in this case, you don't have a geometric interpretation neither for the B variables nor for the connection. You are only working with BF theory. Okay, slide number 20. Now, why is this useful? Okay, first of all, we have just seen that now the duality between a simplicial path integral and the corresponding spin-form model is explicit. It is just the Fourier transform, the non-commutative Fourier transform of the same expression written as a function of the group, or, if you want, a different representation of the corresponding momentum space, where instead of using the quantum numbers given by the spin network representation, use this classical, although non-commutative, B variables coming out of the Fourier transform. So this shows the first point.
Daniele,
Can
I ask a question?
Also two.
Because I'm a bit confused. You said that the group field theory didn't modify it, right?
Sorry?
The group field theory didn't modify. It was just the standard Bulatov.
Yeah, it's just Bulatov.
But it's Feynman diagrams now. The amplitude associated to them are different. Is that the point?
Well, the Feynman answers are exactly the same, except that now we can really read the geometry that was already there in the B variables.
Meaning that the formula Z of gamma that you wrote can be equivalently written just in the usual way with the delta functions on the group.
Yeah. I'm not changing anything. I'm just doing a different representation for the same action and for the same amplitudes.
Okay, thank you.
It took a few seconds to recognize you. Ciao, Simone. So now I want to show you that you can put to use this new representation for not only identifying the geometry of this, the classical geometry of this Feynman amplitudes, but also to identify now at the level of the group field theory some symmetries that we knew were present in those amplitudes, but were not easy to identify at the group field theory level, in particular the translation symmetry. So let me recapitulate what we know about symmetries of BF theory. So in the continuum, we know that the theory, I'm talking about 3D BF theory, has three types of symmetry: a translation symmetry, acting only on the triad variables and depending on a Lie-algebra valued scalar field. We have the local gauge rotation symmetry, depending on a Lie-algebra variable lambda, and we have diffuse symmetry. We also know that these three symmetries are not independent, and more precisely, so you see the formula there, and we know that in particular on shell, so if you use the classical equations of motion, diffeomorphism can be obtained as a combination of translations and rotations. We know that when we go to discrete theory in general, all these continuum symmetries will be broken, simply in the sense that we replace a smooth structure with a discrete one. There will be only a residual symmetry acting on the discrete variables of our theory, and so acting only on edges or vertices of the triangulation. And I refer to you for the analysis of discrete symmetries, in particular of diffeos in 3D and 4D, to the paper by to the work by Bianca and Benjamin. So the discrete symmetries for Bianca had been studied also by Laurent and David some years ago at the level in terms of symmetries of the action. So what we should focus on now is the discrete translation symmetry. And you see the expression there. So again, it's generated by the algebra elements associated to vertices of the triangulation. And the B variables, so the triad variables, discrete triad variables associated to edges of the triangulation are affected by this by the two Lie-algebra elements corresponding to the vertices that are linked by the edge. Okay, so the rotation symmetry can be easily identified also at the level of the bullet of group field theory in terms of group elements, but it's difficult to identify, of course, the translation symmetry because we were lacking a B representation, which is exactly where the translation symmetry acts. So slide number 21. Now we have this B representation. Again, I do some wild violence to the notation by writing the interaction term as I do there. What I mean is simply that, again, I'm simply rewriting in terms of the algebra elements, in terms of the non-commutative variables, the original action without modifying it. So the combinatorial structure of the argument is exactly the same. So briefly, we can define a simple transformation of the group field theory field depending on the algebra elements, again, associated to the three edges. And this is just a shift of the original Lie algebra element, B, with the corresponding Lie algebra element, epsilon. However, because of the closure constraint, there is a resulting constraint on these three transformation parameters, epsilon. So the closure has to hold also for the translated triangle, if you want to think of it this way. You can check that the kinetic term of the theory is invariant, provided you impose a further restriction on the symmetry, on the action of the symmetry at the level of the action, meaning you have to translate both variables, both fields, sorry, by the same Lie algebra elements, when they for corresponding to the same edge. Then what you can check is that the invariance of the interaction term is obtained if you impose some further restriction on the transformation parameters. And the transformation and the restriction, the result of this restriction is exactly that the really independent transformation parameters are associated to vertices of the triangulation. And each argument of the field has to be shifted by the difference of the two Lie algebra elements associated to the two vertices corresponding to the same edge, joined by the same edge. Line number 22. Okay, so you see that as you expect, the resulting transformation is generated by the algebra elements associated to the vertices of the triangulation. It's a symmetry of the group field theory action, and you can verify straightforwardly that it corresponds to the usual, exactly to the translation symmetry at the level of Feynman amplitudes. Then there are a few points that I want to make here. So that's the result. So thanks to this new representation that translates into a simplicial gravity path integral in terms of Feynman amplitudes, we can identify this symmetry very easily at the level of the group field theory.
Yeah, can I insert a question? The symmetry, if you Fourier transform back, how does it look in terms of on the free field in terms of the?
So if you Fourier transform back, of course you don't see so much of the symmetry, but you see the corresponding conservation of momenta, if you want. If you think of this as being the analog of the translation symmetry in a usual scalar field theory.
But if I take a field and make this shift and then
I will need to draw a picture to show you what is the corresponding conserved product of group elements. So you can see that there is for each vertex of the triangulation, there is a corresponding product of the arguments of the field theory in group picture that is conserved. It actually falls to be an entity, to some zero if you want. So that's what you see in the group picture. And this suggests, so the two points I wanted to make. The second one I make it first because it is related to this question. So the point is that because the presence of this symmetry suggests that a change of variable, you can change variables at the level of each field in the same group field theory action. and go from from the algebra elements associated to the edges of the triangulation, to the triangles, to the algebra elements associated to the vertices of the triangles. The combinatorics of the arguments in the field, in the action, in the interaction term, is now the one that I report schematically below. And you see that you have a slightly more local form in the sense that there are three fields now. Each three fields share one element, which correspond to the three triangles sharing a vertex in the tetrahedron. And you can see now the translation symmetry as resulting from this sort of locality in this variable, so in the variable associated to the same vertex of the triangulation. The other two points I wanted to make briefly. One is that what was a local gauge symmetry in the Feynman amplitude of the Gruffield theory, meaning what was a local gauge symmetry from the point of view of the simplicial BF path integral, now becomes a global symmetry at the level of the Grufield theory action. This is in line, again, just a note, this is in line from the interpretation of Grufield theories as a sort of a third quantization, meaning you move one step higher and you expect, for example, diffuse to become global symmetries instead of gauge symmetries as they are in the path integral. The last small point is that because the closure constraint is the discrete equivalent of the metricity of the connection, so one of the two equations of motion of BF theory, and because this constraint, so this equation of motion, is satisfied by the field in the Grufield theory action, now the symmetry we just identified at the level of the Grufield theory action is closer to diffuse than the translation symmetry for first order BF was. And we still have to analyze the implications of this statement, of this point. Okay, slide number 23. Okay, so the other point I want to make is that you can think of this, you can use the same non-commutative Fourier transform to give a new representation for the same loop quantum gravity kinematical states. For example, here I'm treating them to be just generic cylindrical functions for several...
Are you now considering loop quantum gravity in the context of piecewise linear category as opposed to the more general thing that it was supposed
to? For what I've been saying up to now, sure. I was in the simplicial context, and if I consider the corresponding quantum states, you can think of them as the loop quantum gravity ones adapted to the piecewise flat context.
Current one, that is to say, it has to do with
what
the non-commutative.
Yes, what I'm stating now is a bit more general. So you can forget about the construction of a simplicial path integral, the Boulatov model, and so on. What I'm saying is simply, I can consider now a generic cylindrical function depending on several copies of the group, SU2, associated now to an arbitrary graph, gamma, with one group element for each link of the graph. I can express it as a function of the algebra elements instead. It will be a function in a non-commutative space of functions endowed with a star product. And this results from simply applying the same Fourier transform. What can be checked is that the triad operator now act by multiplication. Of course, it's a non-commutative multiplication, meaning I have to use the star product when I perform the multiplication. And you can also check...
Why are you calling it the triad operator? What does it have to do with the fluxes of triads? I mean, if you are just a general graph, if you're not a piecewise linear category, then the cylindrical function is just a function of n, you know, just a bunch of edges. They may be knotted, they may be complicated. And then I agree that I can look at the Lie algebra of them. But then these Lie algebra elements don't have any geometrical interpretation that I can see as fluxes of triads. Because there is no two surface which is kind of canonically associated with an edge.
Yeah, that's okay. That's true. Yeah. So what I'm saying is simply that the statement can be only completed and clarified a little bit with the second one about autonomy operators. So you can check that the autonomy operators instead act as translations on these functions. So you are respecting the dual nature of autonomy operators and triad operators, even in this representation. That's the only sense in which I can think of, in which I can talk of triad operators here and autonomy operators. Okay, so you can, they're actually the same triad and autonomy operators that I can write in the usual group representation. And in particular, for example, the autonomy operators I write here would act in the usual group representation as the multiplicative operators that we know.
Yeah, but in absence of a interpretation of these E's as being fluxes of the triads on some surfaces, these are just abstract E operators in general, unless you are in the, again, piecewise linear category.
I agree. At this stage, the statement is not has nothing to do with geometry yet.
Right, okay.
So what I have under control coming from the previous part of the talk is that if I restrict this construction to the piecewise context, piecewise flat context, so to the simplicial case, then I have an interpretation for the same operators coming from the spin foam or the simplicial gravity path integral representation. Okay, so this is a little bit of more geometric meaning to what I'm doing here, but at this stage, you're right, this is purely abstract. Did I partially answer the question?
You answered the question, right. In the general case, it is abstract, but in the piecewise linear category, one can make a clean geometry.
I suspect that you can make it more concrete from the geometric point of view also outside the simplicial context, but I'm not discussing this here.
Okay.
Okay, and you can extend the usual kinematical inner product. You can rewrite it basically as an inner product in this new representation in terms of functions on the Lie algebra. And what we're doing at the moment is to check that all the rest of the kinematical construction for the Hilbert space of states also goes through, which is cylindrical consistency and so on. Here I close this point by noticing that I would like to stress that here we're using just SU2 group elements. We don't have an interpretation of them as being triad of a corresponding, how to say, four-dimensional geometry. So there's no four-dimensional embedding of these 3D structures yet. In practice, in the context of the Fourier transform, this means that the correct Fourier transform will probably not be this simple SU2 Fourier transform, but what will be induced by the simplicity constraint starting from the SO4 construction in 4D. And I would like to talk about this now, but given that I run out of time, I can skip to the conclusions. And maybe I book a slot for another talk concerning the four-dimensional models for later. Unless, of course, there are questions or people are interested, and then I can spend 10 more minutes afterwards about the four-dimensional models. So I skip to the conclusion, which are in slide number 35. There. So what I've shown is that you can define a new representation for group field theories, and this realizes explicitly a duality between simplicial quantum gravity and spin foam models. This is useful in order to keep under control the simplicial geometry that is already in the corresponding spin foam model, if you have one. Like it is the case in the case I've shown of 3D Ponzano-Reggio model or Bulatov model, It allows to identify and to study in an easier way the symmetries of the theory, and in particular I think it would be a very good basis for studying diffeomorphism in spinform models. It can provide, it does provide in the simplicial context, and it can provide in a more general context a flux representation for loop quantum gravity, at least at the kinematical level. And what I didn't show, but I'm happy to talk about, is how it can provide a new purely geometric framework out of which, thanks to which constructing spinform models and therefore simplicial path integrals for four-dimensional quantum gravity. In a word, well, it's a very nice context in order to implement the simplicity constraints on the bivectors, given that in the new non-commutative representations, your basic variables are exactly the classical bivectors. I believe also that the star product can be of help in defining an evolution operator, and therefore in relating loop quantum gravity, canonical dynamics of loop quantum gravity and groove field theories. And as a more general statement, it brings loop quantum gravity and simplicial quantum gravity in much closer contact with the tools, techniques, and knowledge in non-commutative geometry. I'm sure that there will be much more to do on the basis of this, but I don't have time to discuss it. I don't have time to go to the outlook and a list of open issues. This would be the next two slides, 36 and 37. But I'm happy if you want to discuss the group field theory. The open issues in the group field theory context from my point of view, what are the important ones? And as I said, one of the main aims is to elicit discussion, so I'm happy to keep going. By now you can go to slide 38, where I thank you for your attention.
Questions?
Yeah,
Hello?
Okay.
Yeah, this is Lee Daniela. Daniela, do these techniques make it easier to go to the case where the SU2 itself is quantum deformed, and does there still exist the non-commutative Fourier transform? And might this help us look at those cases for spinform models with quantum group symmetry?
I'm not so sure if Laurent is at the interview today, but I think you have beside you, if he's there, somebody who's more qualified than me about whether you can extend the Fourier transform to the quantum deformed case. For the little I understand, I would doubt it is straightforward, because to start with, you can't really talk of functions on the group, because SU2Q is not a group.
Right, so you would deal with the functions on the algebra.
Okay, so what I would do if I had more time and skill would be to understand better what is the transformation first in the undeformed case between the spin network representation and the representation in terms of functions on the algebra, and then try to extend this mapping to the deformed case. So basing the extension on the representation theory of the SU2Q quantum group, with functions on the group. But again, I'm not really the right person to ask this, I'm afraid.
Let me just come back to what you are actually doing. And this momentum representation, if you like, the non-commutative space representation, is potentially very extremely helpful, and it's a very fertile area.
Just
a side remark is that in quantum cosmology, one can use either of the two representations. And in fact, more contact again with, if you like, what you would call simplicial geometry, or what one would call conventional quantum cosmology, that really required that one worked with the triad representation. Now, in the quantum cosmology context, luckily, one can just go to the group effectively to be an abelian group. And therefore, again, one is really looking at a fixed cell and a fixed simplicial decomposition. So associated with an edge, there is a dual surface and so on. And therefore, one can go back and forth. But one is even further lucky that one has just an abelian context, and therefore Fourier transforms are ordinary Fourier transforms, etc. But I think as we do more and more general models, this non-commutative representation is going to be critical. And my request to you would be to tell us a little bit from your perspective what the open issues are from the group field theory side.
Yeah, so thanks for pointing this out. I agree, of course. Okay, I'm happy, of course, to discuss the open issues, but first maybe it's better to exhaust other questions on the stuff I discussed already, and then I'm happy to talk about things that I think are interesting to do, if you agree. How should I interpret the silence?
Go ahead then.
One question I have is about Bulatov model.
Yeah.
I mean, could you just tell us the final status about convergence and so on? You know, there are these works of the Paris group, or Paris PI group, so to say. And I would like to understand, what do we know about the whole, from the group field theory perspective, about the Bulatov model? And if looking at it from this non-commutative space perspective simplifies anything.
Okay, so the answer to this last point, the last question is I don't know, because we haven't yet analyzed the renormalization of the corresponding field theory in this new sort of momentum space. So I'm not so sure if it simplifies the picture or not. I expect it could, because, for example, for studying... So in non-commutative field theories, the non-commutative structure plays actually a crucial role in the renormalization. So I think it will be important here and potentially helpful, but I don't have any result on that. So you asked me about the status of the Bulatov model concerning finiteness of the perturbation theory, I guess. So I tell you what I understand. So concerning, so we analyzed with Laurent and Razvan Gurao the perturbative renormalization of the model treated as an ordinary field theory. So what we did was the result is that the divergences of the Feynman amplitudes depend very much on the they are located on bubbles, meaning on three cells of the dual Feynman of the Feynman diagrams, and they depend quite crucially on the combinatorial structure of these bubbles, in particular on the topology of their boundary, of their two-dimensional boundary triangulations. What we did in this paper was to, first of all, set up an algorithm for identifying the boundary triangulation on this on each bubble, given the triangulation defining the whole Feynman diagram. Then, using a brute force cutoff, we studied the behavior in this cutoff of the Feynman amplitudes. We identified a class of diagrams that allow for a contraction procedure, so that is allow basically for an explicit evaluation of the amplitudes, by an iterative procedure similar to the way you evaluate divergences in usual field theory, and we proved a power counting theorem for this type of diagrams. We don't have a more general power counting theorem for arbitrary graphs, for arbitrary diagrams of the theory. Then we conjecture, but again, we have indications that this is true, but no proof, that this subclass of diagrams play the same role that planar diagrams play in matrix models in two dimensions. In particular, moreover, the definition of this type of diagrams is just the three-dimensional extension of the of a definition you can give a planar diagram in 2D. And then we also checked that all these Feynman all these diagrams are of trivial topology, and they all correspond to manifold, which again leads to the other conjecture that there exists a generalization of the large n limit of matrix models to this Bulatov model, in which only this subclass of diagrams remain, only these diagrams dominate. But on this, we don't have a proof. And then concerning the results of the Paris group, first of all, we know another thing about this this model. We know that the perturbative series diverges, but we also know that if you modify slightly the original model, the original action, by adding a new interaction term of the same order, so still a phi to the fourth term, but with a slightly different combinatorics of arguments connecting the fields, the model becomes Borel-summable. And this has been shown by Laurent and David Loapre some years ago. Then what the Paris group have done is to apply very elegant, I would say, constructive field theory techniques to this model. They have shown that the addition of the of this modification to the potential makes the perturbative convergence worse, but they've proven in a different way the Borel summability of the model, and they've also proven the Borel summability of the free energy on top of the Borel summability of the partition function, which was not known before. And I would say that the most important point of that paper was the generalization of constructive field theory techniques to group field theory, which can lead to much more progress in the future. And sorry for being long.
More questions? Okay, would you like to take 5 minutes to speak about open problems then?
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Okay, so I mentioned, so go to slide number 36. So again, it will be probably the subject of a following of a future talk. The first open problem, of course, is to find some agreement on what is a good group field theory model for four-dimensional quantum gravity. But in light of this duality I've shown between simplicial gravity path integrals and spin form representation, what I now understand to mean by correct is that there should be a compelling expression in terms of a simplicial gravity path integral. So meaning that in that representation, it should be possible to check that we have implemented nicely the simplicity constraints, and that we also have implemented nicely any secondary constraints that should be present in the simplicial path integral. And then, of course, we should have control over the spin form representation of the same model. And thanks to the spin form representation, we should have a good understanding of the space of boundary states of the theory, possibly with a clear relation with blue quantum gravity models. And in general, of course, an open issue is, from my perspective, is a proper second quantization of spin network wave functions, because that could be one way to relate loop quantum gravity, canonical loop quantum gravity, directly with group field theories, not necessarily passing through the spin form formulation. Okay, we don't know much about the classical solutions of the group field theory equations. We should try to know more, also because I think that this would be one good way to learn about the possible physical meaning of the group field theory coupling constant. And I already discussed some of the issues involved in the control of the group field theory Feynman expansion concerning divergences or Borel summability. And then on slide 37, well, I discussed during the talk one of the main open issues, which is understanding the symmetries of group field theories, and therefore of simplicial quantum gravity, and therefore of spin form models. In particular, we should try to focus on diffuse, and I think the three-dimensional example would be very useful for this. But again, what I see as the main open issue is the continued approximation of these models. and the link with generativity and making the connection with generativity. Now, for me, this amounts to answering one question, which is, first of all, whether there is whether we can give a physical interpretation of this implicial regime. So, can we interpret the regime in which we have only very few simplices or a very simple spin network on the boundary of our theory in terms of a continuum geometry, and in which approximation, in which regime? If we can do this, then of course we don't need to take any further continuum approximation, at least in some regime, and we should just use the results of simplicial quantum gravity and of the spin form representation in order to study the corresponding physics. And I think, for what I understand, that this is the point of view taken in the graviton propagator calculations in the spin form context. But then, again, let me again stress the fact that the question, I think, should be asked at the level of boundary states. Only depending on how we answer this question at the level of boundary states, then we can try to identify approximation techniques or effective dynamic or the effective dynamics of our theories in the appropriate regime at the covariant level, at the level of spin forms or at the level of Gruffudd theory. But the question is a kinematical one. And in other words, relates to the question, the physical question we are asking, so to the observables of the theory we're trying to compute. The other possible answer to the question is that no, I mean, a few simplices are not enough, if not in very, very special circumstances. And one is to take a continuum limit or a continuum approximation, and that corresponds, from the point of view of the Gruffudd theory, to studying the regime of many Gruffudd theory particles, if you want. So complicated boundary states. And at this point, okay, we don't have the results, but we have a tool, which is the Gruffudd theory itself, meaning we have a field theory formulation for physics of many particles, and we should try to develop the corresponding statistical field theory, study the different phases and possibly the phase transitions. And the suggestion here is that continuum space could be some sort of Gruffudd theory hydrodynamics appropriate to the regime of many particles. And that if we have to look for a GR, for continuum GR in some regime of Gruffudd theory, I would suggest or would first guess that it corresponds to some Gruffudd theory hydrodynamics. But again, on this I don't have results. So we should discuss it in some even later in the future seminar. Thank you again.
Thank you.